The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight on WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this, the second day of November in 2025. And we'll say hello to our legendary engineer, Brian Graves, who's sitting a few feet away taking care of business. How you doing, Brian? Good. We got a good show ahead of us, Brian. Glad you've tuned in tonight, folks, wherever you may be on this planet. Great show in the offing for you, as I said. Up first, we welcome back to the show the great Hall of Famer, the Dutch master himself, Bert Blyleven. It's always great to have a storied Hall of Famer like Bert with us. And in the second half, we'll welcome in a great hitter, a guy who hit 414 career home runs. Darrell Evans will join us. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show tonight. We've got some great sports talk waiting for you up ahead. I'm excited that you've chosen to stop by and hang with us tonight. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page. It's called The Talk of New York Sports. You'll find sports information, show information, great pictures. Stop by, take a look. You can also follow me on X at B Donahue WGBB, all one word, at BDONOHUEWGBB. That's where I'm at on X. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're all cataloged out on the website, www.sportstalknewyork.com. Go out there, catch up on the show anytime you want. Well, our first guest, he is the first Dutch-born member of the National Baseball Hall of Fame, two-time All-Star, two-time World Series champion, threw a no-hitter in 1977, and he's the author of 287 big league wins. He was enshrined into the hallowed halls at Cooperstown in 2011, and I'm happy and honored to welcome back to the show tonight, Bert Blyleven. Bert, good evening.
Well, thank you, Brian. First of all, you're full of crap. You know that.
Why is that?
Well, you told me, you know, the engineers don't care, and then I'm listening to the intro, and it seems like, you know, you run the damn show. Where's Bill?
No, Brian's at the board, Bird. He's at the controls. It's like the bridge on the Starship Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, Brian is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. He's the man.
Yeah, well, I got on the phone, and he said, this is the engineer. I said, what's your name? He goes, well, it doesn't really matter. I said, yeah, Doug, you have a name. What's your name?
That's
and he told me Brian, so... Come on, Brian, geez, give yourself some credit.
He needs to step up to the plate, Bert, and take some credit.
I'll knock him down right now.
Well, Bert, let's get down to business. You were born in the Netherlands. Your parents came to America to escape the Nazis like so many others. And your father really got you started in baseball.
Yeah, actually, we left after the war. My mother had told us a story as kids that when the Nazis did come in, they were looking for my grandfather, older men to work the concentration camps, and they actually hid him underneath the house when they came in. I guess if they had found him, I may not have a mother, you know what I mean,
yeah.
At that time of the year. But after the war, my dad had a brother, my Uncle Cor, that lived in California, and he kind of wanted to come out to leave Holland and come to the United States. My mother did not, but she said she would follow my dad, Joe, anywhere he went. So from Holland, I was born in Holland along with my older sister and brother, and we went to Canada for 4 years and then immigrated and became U.S. citizens the right way. We came in the United States in 1957, and we became naturalized in 1962 through my mom and dad.
Nice, great story, Bert. Yeah, what adventures! to say the least. Now, your dad was a big Dodger fan. You grew up in Southern California, so he must have started you on being a Dodger fan too, right?
Well, believe it or not, when we came to the United States, I was about 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old, and my dad was actually, he loved soccer, coming from Europe, and we would go to soccer games, and then lo and behold, my Uncle Cor got my dad involved in listening to Vin Scully and Jerry Doggett with the L.A. Dodgers, and my dad would listen to the games, and he went to a couple without me. He did bring me one time when Sandy Koufax was pitching against Juan Marichal,
wow.
And we sat up in the nosebleed area way up in left field, and I saw these guys going at it, and I thought, you know what, this looks like a pretty good game.
Yeah.
And I started playing a little league when I was about 10 years old. I started off as a catcher, Bill, and I guess my first coach, Mr. Price, which is a fireman, and he said, you know, do you want to pitch? Because I was throwing a ball back harder to a pitcher than he was throwing to me. And so I started pitching and fell in love with it.
Wise move. Very wise move by Mr. Price there, Bert. Definitely. Now, we switch forward to 1970. You're on the Twins. Louis Tiant, I guess he was their ace at the time, went down, and they promoted you. And early win. He was a coach with the Twins, I presume. Early win compared you to Herb Score.
Well, I did not meet Hurley Winn. My pitching coach at that time was Marv Grissom, Bill. Louis Tiant was, Twins had a four-man staff. I was in spring training as an 18-year-old just out of high school, and I got to watch Jim Perry, who won the Cy Young in 1970 by winning 24 games, Jim Cott, fellow Dutchman, Louis Tiant, and Dave Boswell. They were the four starters.
Okay.
And then around the end of May, Louis Tiant and Dave Boswell both got hurt, and I was in AAA, and I got the opportunity to come up and take Louis or Dave's spot in a rotation. And, you know, I learned so much from Jim Cott and Jim Perry, just watching the ball games and listening to, listening to what they had to say. I was 19 years old. I was a rookie. I was to be seen and not heard from, and that's the way I looked at it.
And those are two great guys to learn from, definitely, Bert.
Oh, yeah.
Bert Blylevin with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, the great curveball gained attention. I read where guys like Cepeda, your fellow Hall of Famer, the late Orlando Cepeda, said it was the best they'd ever seen. And, of course, Cha-Cha hit against Sandy Koufax. So that's not a bad comparison to be made there.
Well, actually, I learned my curveball listening to Vin Scully and Jerry Doggett describe Koufax's drop.
Wow.
Because, of course, back in the late 60s, they had the higher mound. They had the 15 to maybe 20-inch mound with a great drop-off. And, you know, Sandy had such a great curveball, over-the-hand curveball, but I called it a drop. And just listening to Vin Scully describe his drop, I went in the backyard and threw against the block wall or played catch with my dad, and I couldn't throw the curveball until I was about 13 or 14 years old because my dad heard an interview with Mr. Koufax, with Vin Scully, that Vin interviewed Sandy, and Sandy said if he had ever had a son, he wouldn't teach him the curveball until he was about 13 or 14.
Ah.
Because Sandy, of course, had the arthritic elbow, and maybe he at that time felt that caused some of the issue. But anyway, lo and behold, I learned my curveball in the rotation to try to make it drop straight over the top, like if you're looking at your watch, 12 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a while to master it, but about my senior year in high school, I think I got it down.
It's great, Bert, how we picked up tips on how to play the game from the great broadcasters we had back then. So the same thing with me with the Mets broadcasters. The way they painted the picture, you could really add to your game through that.
Well, Vin was the best.
Yeah.
He had Maury Wills and Jim Gilliam and Wes Parker and Frank Howard, who my dad idolized, out in right field. They had some great ball clubs back then, and, before we go any further, congratulations to the Dodgers on winning the World Series.
Yes, a great job. Really a great series, Bert. I wanted to ask you about that later on. Yeah, a great series. I don't think the Blue Jays have anything to hang their heads about, though. They really played a great series.
I'll tell you what. Heck no. You know what? They had their opportunities.
They did.
You know, they had the opportunities in Game 6 with man on second and third to hopefully come back and tie it. That did not work out. And then even they had the lead in Game 7 and just didn't work their way. But they have, you're right, Bill, they have nothing to hang their head on at all. They should be very proud of the way that they went about their business. Every game was so excited. You know, I'm on Facebook, and I just read where people say this might have been one of the best World Series games, the seven games that they've ever seen. So, to me, the best game ever was Jack Morris beating the Atlanta Braves in 1991 by going 10 shutout innings. But This was a great series.
It certainly was, and we're happy to have a series like that come along. Now, you mentioned your time in Pittsburgh was really frustrating for you because Chuck Tanner was the skipper, and he had a reputation for having a real quick hook, didn't he?
Well, you know, I had 20 no decisions in 1979,
wow.
And I don't know if anybody has had that many since as a starting pitcher. I was 12-5, but, you know, it wasn't as much as what did not upset me is coming from the American League, I pitched every fourth day. So I'm pitching 280, 290, one year, 325 innings.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the National League, which I got traded from the Texas Rangers in 1978. And all of a sudden, I'm only pitching 230, 240 innings. And I never had an issue with Chuck Tanner, greatest manager, I think, besides Tom Kelly and many others that I ever had. But I always wondered if I'm only asked to go five or six innings, and I wasn't a good hitter. So, you know, if it's a 1-1 game in a sixth inning, I expected to be pinch hit for.
Right.
Or the seventh inning. I expected that. But why do I have to wait 5 or 6 days to pitch again? I was losing 50 innings out of my golden arm that God gave me. So, yeah, that was frustrating. But you know what? We won the World Series, and that was the bottom line. You know, that's what it's all about, is doing what the Dodgers did. And, you know, 1979 Pirates was a great year, great ball club, so many great players led by Willie Stargell, Dave Parker, and so many others.
Yeah, another great series, Bert. Like we said, a storied ball club that We Are Family, Pittsburgh Pirate Club. And you mentioned the Hall of Famers, Stargell, Dave Parker. You had Kent DeColvey coming out of the pen. The Lumber Company, really good ball players on that Pirate squad. In 1988, though, Bert, you finally returned to Southern California with the Angels. That must have brought a smile to your face.
Well, it did. Other than I was 39 years old, you know, or 38 years old, I
right.
wanted to, you know, of course, you play, you know, 18, 19 years in the big leagues, and your dream was always to play at home in a more or less way. I grew up in Southern California, but to play for the Angels was a great honor. My first year was really good, 17-5, good ERA. Then the next year I hurt my shoulder and kind of went downhill after that, really. And I think God said enough was enough and to go do something else. So I did, and I ended up broadcasting for 25 years for the Minnesota Twins. So God has been good to me. Baseball's been very, very good to me.
What got you into broadcasting, Bert? What piqued your interest about getting into the booth?
Well, I did some college games in Southern California and worked with Steve Fisiak, and we got along really well. Steve Fisiak was a great announcer for the Angels and also the Kansas City Royals, and we just got to talking, and I did a couple games, and Dave St. Peter was the president of the Minnesota Twins, and he had heard that I was doing some games, and he asked me if I'd be interested in doing some games when the Twins came out to play the Angels. That had to be, well, I'm going to guess, 1995, 96, in that range right there. And I did the games. I did some games in Oakland, and Tommy John was the mainstay for the Twins at that time as a color analyst. And Mr. St. Peter asked me if I would do half the games the following year, which I did. And then the following year, Dick Bramer and I did all the games for, we were partners for 25 years.
And there you go. Yeah, the rest is history. Bert Blyleven gracing our airwaves tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, I spoke to Andre Dawson 2 weeks ago about this next topic, Bert. Sportsmanship. I mean, this year you had Vladdy Guerrero sticking it to the Yankees after the ALDS. The Brew Crew flying the L flag after beating the Cubs. These days you have all kinds of dancing gestures after a hit. I remember Mickey Mantle saying when he hit a home run, he rounded the bases with his head down. And he said that the pitcher probably felt bad enough already without him rubbing it in. What do you think about these guys today and the seemingly lack of sportsmanship?
I'll mention one name, Bob Gibson.
Oh, boy.
another name, Don Drysdale. Back then, you didn't do that stuff. You know, you played the game hard. You respected the other team, even though maybe you didn't like them. You respected them, and after a nine-inning ball game, and hopefully, you know, you go about your business. The flipping of the bat, I'm sorry, don't do that when I'm on the mound because you're going to find one in your ribs. It was a different game back then. You know, I grew up listening and watching Gibson and Drysdale go about their business, and that's the type of pitcher I wanted to be. But respect me. I never shot you down like Perez did, when he struck out somebody. I respected you, even though maybe I struck you out or you hit a home run. Hit a home run, run around the bases. And, that's the game. But but all the analytics that are in the game today and pitchers only going five innings and tipping their hat to the crowd that they did their job, that's probably a part that I still have problems with. Starters, you know, I had 242 complete games, 60
right.
shutouts.
Mm-hmm.
Those are things I took a lot of pride in, knowing that even though I may have lost 1-0 or 2-1, I still had that ball in the ninth inning on my hand.
Yeah, and that's all that matters. That's for sure. And as you say,
what matters, Bill, is you win. That's mm-hmm. what matters. That's the bottom line.
Bottom line. You're right, Bert. Yeah, that's for sure. Now, the controversy of umpiring today, Bert. They're being questioned by the implementation of this ABS system that's coming in. I admit some umpires this year seem to have some tough games where they were questions and probably rightfully so. What do you think about the ABS and how would you have dealt with it when you were playing?
Well, first of all, Bill, I am old school.
Right.
I believe that the umpires go back there and they don't particularly want to miss a pitch. Every umpire has a different strike and ball strike zone, more or less. Now you have the computerized that's going to do it. I don't like the computer. I think it's a human game. You're taking the human element out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Maddux would have never won 350 games if he had that machine because he could hit his spots. And remember, it's a 17-inch plate. But a ball is about 3 inches wide, so if you can hit that corner, all of a sudden it's a 23-inch plate. That was the goal, I think, of pitchers that had control, not trying to overthrow it and throw 100 miles an hour. There was only Randy Johnson and Nolan Ryan, I think, in our era that could do that for as long as they did. They're freaks of nature. But most guys went out there and tried to, pitch and control the game. Umpires, I hope, it's sad to me because umpires, they work their butt off. Mm-hmm. Think about these four guys that are calling a game in Minnesota, and then 3 days later they have to fly to Chicago and do three or four games, and then they have to fly to Kansas City and do three or four. It's not easy for these guys. And I respected umpires, and I think what they're doing is they're taking the umpires completely out of the ball game. And they're second-guessing every call. The media's gotten so big that, just play the game. My God, don't nitpick if that ball was 2 inches outside or if it was, up in a strike zone. Hitters know.
We all knew it.
Yeah. They've also taken the color out of the game by inhibiting these umpires. I mean, you remember the guy named Dutch Rennert, the way he used to call balls and strikes. And how about Ron Luciano? You remember Ron Luciano?
Oh, yeah. Ron, the umpire behind me, a couple of them. Emin Ashford.
Yeah.
You know, guys had personalities. Back when I think I'm going old school again. I don't mean to talk that way, but
that's okay.
There were American League umpires and National League umpires. Now everybody's under one hat. And it's harder, I think, to pitch now because the umpire doesn't know a certain pitcher because he's never seen him before. Where I think back when we pitched, I would have the same umpire behind the plate maybe three or four times throughout the summer. And I would know his tendencies and he would know mine.
Mm-hmm.
Would I throw a 3-2 curveball with bases loaded and nobody out? You know? Yeah, because I did it before and he was maybe behind the plate. He knew that. He wasn't going to be surprised. But now with everybody under the hat and then, you know, of course, umpires now, they get 2 or 3 weeks off at a time and then another 2 or 3 weeks off. There's so many of them.
Right.
I think as a player, you don't really know what their tendencies are because they're a big part of the game. And it's sad to say they're taking it away.
Right. That's exactly true. Now, being a Hall of Famer, Bert, Rob Manfred made a move a while back reinstating Pete Rose, Joe Jackson, the other members of the 1919 Chicago White Sox. Now, if you were on the committee when Pete comes up, how would you feel about voting for Pete Rose for the Hall of Fame?
To be honest with you, I'm honest. I'm a very honest person.
Right.
I love Pete. Nobody's going to get 4,200 hits like he did again. He was one of a kind. He was Charlie Hustle. If he had just admitted that the issues that he had at the time, that he would go to, Gambling Anonymous, whatever, and clean his act up, I would vote for him. But what he went through, no, I would not vote for him. And as I would not vote for Roger Clemens or say Alex Rodriguez, which that's another story. And then like Barry Bonds, they cheated a game by taking steroids. They cheated.
Right.
Sorry, that's the way I feel.
No, I agree.
So I agree don't with you, put Bert. Me on a committee.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. Some guys believe like you. Bottom line, you broke the rules, and you got to deal with it. And that's
if you were ever in a clubhouse, fans that listen right now, if you ever took a tour of the clubhouse, when you walk out the door, there's a sign that says that the gambling situation, the drug situation. That went through baseball for a while, a period. I think that baseball's done a great job of cleaning all that up. Now they bring in, what is that called? The gambling thing that you can bet on. What's that?
You got FanDuel and all kinds of things that they.
You wonder why, I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like gambling, where you can bet on. This guy's going to throw a strike on this pitch or not, and it just somebody's making a lot of money on this, and it's not right.
It should be cleaned up. I agree with you 100%, Bert. Now, your storied career in broadcasting, we spoke about that. You had your great habit of circling people with the telestrator in the stands. That became legendary in Minnesota. Was Vin Scully one of your influences in the booth?
No, John Madden was. John Madden with football. You know how if you watch the football game way back when and he was announcing, he'd do circles and he would use the telestrator. This is a defensive lineman going this way. This is a running back. Oh, look at the hole they have. And he would draw certain things. Well, they gave me a telestrator in Kansas City 1 year. And I said, well, how do I use this thing? And they showed me. But if I'm going to do a little line when a ball is hit to left center and I'm going to follow that ball, I didn't feel that was something I had to do on a telestrator. You're already seeing it live.
Right.
Or on replay. So anyway, we came back from an inning, and about the seventh inning, John Stroh was in the truck. He's one of our producers, and he said, you know, just do something with that telestrator. And they came back with a gentleman in Kansas City that had a Twins uniform on. He was, had a hat and everything. And I said, well, you are hereby circled. I thought it was fun. From there, we went. That was like a Sunday. On Monday, we ended up in Detroit. And somebody brought a sign that said, we drove 646 miles from Detroit Lakes to watch the Twins play. And I circled a sign. And I said, you are all hereby circled. And it just kind of became something that when we back to Minnesota, people brought signs, and you know, it was a lot of fun. We had to me, it was a way, great way for Dick Bramer and I to be part of the fans. Right. The fans were part of our game, and that's what the game's all about. It's a fans' game. These guys are out there busting their tail end as far as the players, but it's the fans. You watch your reaction. If you watch a World Series, the reaction of the fans, whether it's the joy of a home run or, you know, the sadness of a strikeout, you know, in Montreal, I mean, in Toronto, you know, you just watch those people react. The excitement, the highs and lows, that's what the game's all about. And, you know, I think Fox did a great job of displaying that throughout all the seven games.
Yeah, they really did. And as you say, Circle Me Bert became legendary in Minnesota. The fans absolutely loved it. Now, in the couple of minutes we have left, Bert, I know you were a great prankster. I want to ask you about the wonderful world of Hot Foot. Now, what's your technique in giving a really effective Hot Foot?
Well, first of all, you need a really good Bic lighter, a long one.
Right.
You can only, the players that could participate in me lighting their shoelaces on fire are guys that are not in the lineup. They have to be on the bench and kind of looking the other way. My most famous, I think, hot foot was Tom Selleck before he did that movie in Japan, Little Baseball or Big Baseball, whatever that movie was.
Yeah, right.
He was allowed in our dugout in Anaheim. Because he was going to Japan to do the movie, and I had met him once before, a couple times before, because he's always at different ballparks taking batting practice. He was a big Tiger fan, and I went up and introduced myself to him because I'm a big Tom Selleck fan. Mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden, lo and behold, he's in our dugout in Anaheim, and they let him stay for the game, and he told me, you're not going to get me. I said, what do you mean? You're not going to light me up, right? Well, Louis Polonia, our left fielder, about the fourth or fifth inning, made a great catch out in left field. And, of course, they're going to show it back on the Jumbotron. And Chuck Finley and Kirk McCaskill, and I was sitting two over from Tom Selleck. He was sitting in the middle. And we all said, oh, you got to watch this. Well, when he watched that, I put my Bic lighter out, and I shot. I not only lit his left shoelaces on fire, also got his right shoelaces on fire. And of course, it only takes a second, and I got up and I told Doug Rader, the manager, I said, I got him. And Doug looked around and started laughing, and lo and behold, all of a sudden the gray flames come up and I got Tom Selleck. And in the movie itself, he's underneath the bench lighting somebody's shoes on fire. I didn't get any residuals or anything like that.
Yeah, no.
All right.
And he learned
that from me.
He learned it from the master, that's for sure. Well, Bert, always an honor and a pleasure to have you with us. Hey, thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend some of it with us up here in New York. Give my best to your lovely wife, Gail. She really helped me out to get you on the air with us. And I wish a great holiday season to you folks.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me. And Brian, keep doing a great job you're doing, buddy.
He give you a thumbs up, Bert. Yeah.
All right.
That is the great Bert Blyleven, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in a former major leaguer who he posted some really great numbers, folks. 414 homers. That's Mr. Darrell Evans. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York.
Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back. We are back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB AM/FM radio, live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island, New York, USA, North America, planet Earth, Milky Way galaxy. That's where you'll find us. So if you have any doubt, if you're in the International Space Station, you know exactly where to find us. The Fall Classic, folks, now a memory. But what a memory. Probably the best World Series we've seen in a while. The Toronto Blue Jays understandably upset about it, but they really have nothing to hang their heads about, as we just spoke to Bert Blyleven about. Great ball club. They played fine baseball. Aside from missing some opportunities to cash in a few times, we've seen the career of future Hall of Famer Clayton Kershaw come to a successful end. He has said he's coming back, but we'll see about another man headed to Cooperstown, Max Scherzer, if he does actually come back next year. He pitched like the bulldog that he's always been. And right now I'd like to read you a short passage that I post on my Facebook feed at the completion of the World Series every year. It's from a piece called The Green Fields of the Mind, and it's written by the late commissioner of Major League Baseball, A. Bartlett Giamatti. He says, "It breaks your heart. It is designed to break your heart. The game begins in the spring when everything else begins again, and it blossoms in the summer, filling the afternoons and evenings, and then as soon as the chill rain comes, it stops and leaves you to face the fall alone. You count on it, rely on it to buffer the passage of time, to keep the memory of sunshine and high skies alive, and then just when the days are all twilight, when you need it most, it stops. Today, November 2nd, it stopped and summer was gone." That's The Green Fields of the Mind, folks. A. Bartlett Giamatti. And I just want to let you know, spring training is exactly 100 days off, folks. 100 days until pitchers and catchers report to Mets camp in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Check my Facebook page, The Talk of New York Sports, and we will begin the countdown. Our next guest, he's been called by baseball historian Bill James the most underrated player in baseball history. He was a two-time All-Star, a World Series champion with the Detroit Tigers in 1984. He had over 2,200 hits and, of course, like we said, 414 big league homers. He had 100 homers with three different teams, folks. That's pretty wild stat there. He's a member of the San Francisco Giants Wall of Fame. I welcome back to the show tonight, Darrell Evans. Darrell, good evening.
Good evening. Hey, you guys, what are you ready to forget about what happened the last 2 weeks? My gosh, that was exciting, wasn't it?
Great series. Yeah, who are you rooting for, Darrell?
Well, I hate the Dodgers, So even though I grew up in Los Angeles, Pasadena, California, but they weren't out there when I was growing up yet, so I didn't really have them as one of my favorite teams. Actually, the Braves were my favorite team.
Ah, okay.
And my favorite player of all growing up was Eddie Matthews, the Braves Hall of Fame third baseman, who I ended up playing for. And
right.
He was my hitting coach when I first got to the major leagues. I mean, it was incredible to have that kind of opportunity to be, I mean, just to be around, get an autograph from your favorite player, and then I end up playing with him. And, of course, his buddy, Hank Aaron.
Yeah.
So, I was actually rooting for, I guess, Toronto in a way, because I know how important it is for the fans and everybody else in identity to win one time. You know, I got an opportunity after playing 15 years in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that dream you grow up dreaming about, the opportunity. Oh, my gosh. And then, you know, reality kind of sets in a little bit. And then you find out you really can't do too much about it.
Right.
I mean, just think, you know, it was, they were two outs away from, or, you know, two outs away from winning it all. And then now, you know, it's just such a disappointment for everybody. That, to me, one of the best things that happened winning a World Series was the parade and having everybody kind of be your teammates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they live and die with you, and to get just that one opportunity. And, you know, and Michigan was, because they hadn't won it very often or hadn't won it for a long time, and traditional city and everything. So, you know, it's going to be a disappointment, but it's going to be something they'll look back and go how proud they were that, you know, their team played so good to play in the seventh game and down to the end. And, you know, you'd go through, start in February and hope and pray and give anything to be in for somebody to go, oh, you're going to get to play in the World Series? Oh, man. And then just playing maybe one of the best ones of all time. Of course it was.
Yeah.
But you just think the last two games made us forget about the 18-inning game before. So it was pretty incredible.
I enjoyed it
very much. I was nervous just sitting there watching and knowing and putting myself in their spots and everything else. And then, you know, you learn to turn around and you go, man, there's so much luck involved.
Yeah.
Talking
about the Blue Jays, Darryl, it's like Maxwell Smart used to say, missed it by that much. You know, they were right there.
Yeah, that doesn't make you feel any better.
No.
I guarantee you that. You know, you're sitting there in the ninth inning and you're getting, you know, and you got a chance and you think things are going the right way, and then, oh my gosh, just gets ripped away from you, and you know, and then you get another chance and you get another chance, and man, it's just, thank God I didn't have to, you know. We won in 84 and 7 and won in the playoffs, and so, you know, we had the best team and we had the best year and one of the best years of ever, and it worked out for us. And then,
right,
you know, just to even think about what these guys had to go through. I mean, the reality this morning of waking up and going, oh my gosh, are we ever going to get another shot at that? So but they put on a great show, and you know, I mean, you look at it and you go, well, you know, Toronto now, you know, the Jets a free agent, are they going to sign him back? You know, they came from last to first, and then are they going to ever get a chance to do that again? And then, you know, if the Dodgers would have lost, then it was like, you know, they got $1 billion pitching staff, and they didn't all do very good. We're not as, you know, they weren't lights out. So it's there's a lot more to it, I guess. But that parade makes everything, you know, you never forget it, of course.
Yeah. Well, as Darryl said, early on with the Braves, he worked with his idol, the great Hall of Famer, Eddie Matthews. Now, in 1983, I think it was, Darryl, you had 41 homers for the Braves. Davey Johnson hit 43, and, of course, the great Hank Aaron hit 40. Tell us what spots you guys hit in the lineup and how you think opposing pitchers approach three guys who hit 40 home runs apiece.
Well, you know, you could see how it probably was, although at the time they wouldn't admit it to pitchers, but they do now. You know, now it's like, okay, we can have some fun with it. But, you know, I was still a young player. My third year, that was 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And my third year, No, that's, don't be sorry. It was great.
Yeah.
And Eddie, and then they put me hitting third in front of Hank. And, you know, it was like, oh, my gosh, this was, I mean, the thrill of just being around him every day, mm-hmm. watching the best player in the game at the time and maybe forever go about his business, and you're hitting in front of him. And You know, the reality set is like, hey, my job is just got on base for the greatest hitter in the game right now. And it was something I had to kind of not learn how to do, but I had a good eye, and I led the league in walks a couple, two or three times almost every year. And, you know, like I said, getting on base. And then Eddie told me, he goes, hey, you know what? Yeah, you get on base and everything, but you know what? They're gonna try to pitch you probably with the guy behind you, and so do some damage. And, you know, it was like, so remember, you're in scoring position when he's walking to that batter's box. So that was a big boost of confidence, obviously, and everything. And then we had kind of a mindset, Hank hit fourth, and Dusty Baker hit fifth.
Ah, okay.
You know, he hit 29 home runs, I think, that year, too. So, and then Davey hit sixth. And, you know, Davey had come from a world champion, Baltimore Orioles, and was an all-star, great player and everything, but he wasn't Frank Robinson or Brooks Robinson. But all of a sudden, when he got traded to us, I don't know if Eddie took him in the back and told him, go, hey, we hit home runs here. So, you know, all of a sudden, it becomes kind of, it was contagious. And at the same time, remember, you know, Hank's 40th home run in 1973 was his 713th home run. So the emphasis was all on Hank. You know, we didn't, I mean, we just kind of went along for the ride. So it was like, like the Dodgers, you know, the top three guys, you know.
Yeah.
Ty and Betts and Freddie Freeman, yeah, we had a couple more guys like that. So, you know, you see it and you watch it on TV and you can imagine, it's like, oh, well, I got the third hitter, Darrell Evans, out, and I got Hank Aaron out. Oh, and then Dusty Baker and Davey Johnson come up. So looking back, I was a young player, not inexperienced, but starting to get experience and figuring out how you go about doing that. And, you know, everybody took the role seriously, and it's contagious. And, you know, I mean, we were expected to hit two or three home runs a game. So it was pretty fun.
And we're speaking to Darrell Evans tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, you were on base, Darrell, when Hank hit number 715. Describe that scene for us.
Oh, my gosh. So how about that? Like I said, when he got to 700, people had always talked about it. It was something, that'll never happen. Nobody ever, you know, get close to Babe Ruth or anything. And all of a sudden,
guess what?
And it was like everybody was going, well, if it was, it'd be Willie Mays or Mickey Mantle or, no, it was Hank Aaron. And, you know, he was played in Milwaukee. And, you know, they won a couple championships there, and you know, but nobody was, okay, it was Milwaukee, it wasn't in New York. And then, you know, it was in Atlanta, so there was never that, so much of that big thing until he got close, like 700. And then all of a sudden, the world changed and descended on Atlanta because of Hank, obviously. I think that was one of the first times they started showing his at-bat. You know, every at bat, and, you know, because it's like, well, we don't want to miss that. And, you know, he was going after the icon in the history of baseball, Babe Ruth. And, you know, so it was as exciting as you can imagine it was. And yet there was still like this, well, it's not, it shouldn't be Hank. And, you know, Louis Kuhn, the commissioner, was going to put an asterisk on it when he beat Babe Ruth because he had more bats just the ridiculous stuff, which should have been just the opposite of, oh my gosh, can you imagine somebody doing what Hank did? And you know, Hank was such a beautiful man, great, classy guy. You know, pretty quiet, I guess, to the press and everything. But, man, all of a sudden, like I said, you know, 200, 300 reporters from all over the world were descending on there, and every at-bat, every game and everything. And, And I like again, it was my job to get on base. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was on base for 700. I was in base for 710, 711, 712, 713, and 714, and 715. So that was my kind of focus, and it was great to just, you know, be around him. And, you know, we try to help him, you know. With, I mean, everybody goes, oh, it's a pressure. And yeah, that's why he was so good. There was only one. There was only one person could handle all that so-called pressure.
What a man.
And, you know, he didn't go on any prolonged slumps or anything. And it was important because it felt like, you know, they still had to kind of pitch to him because of what the rest of us were doing around him. And it was just what you can imagine it to be.
Yeah.
Just a magical thing. We were part of baseball history because of our teammate and because of the guy that we love so much and the most respected guy in baseball. So it was fantastic, of course.
Magical.
You know,
yeah.
Atlanta won the greatest sports town at the time. And, you know, we filled the place every game, of course. And then the day after he hit 715, we had 5,000 people. So it should have been a bigger thing. And I think when Barry Bonds finally, you know, went by, Hank finally maybe got some of the accolades and the respect that he should have gotten when he was going
through
it.
The first time, right. You're right, Darryl. Now, I want to ask you, you hit 414 homers, as we've said a few times. It's so prevalent today, and I think it's kind of ridiculous. Did you ever flip the bat?
Heck no, are you kidding me? I had to face Bob Gibson and Nolan Ryan off, you know, not just those guys. I had to face Steve Carlton and Bob Gibson back-to-back and stuff like that. So we were always taught, of course, and Eddie and Hank, and you watch how Hank did it. Hank never did anything like that because and like Eddie always said, it's like, hey, you know, run around the bases just like you always do, and maybe you'll get a chance next time up, and nobody's going to be throwing at you, and they're going to have to do that. And plus, it was a sign of respect back then. Now it's a clown show in a lot of ways. We all know that, and especially the guys that played. That I played with, and the guys before that I played with, too. Did they ever do that? No.
No.
So, you know, it's become, you know, we're entertainers. Obviously, you come to the ballpark, you pay your money, and you want a show, but, you know, that just, to me, takes away from it. Every time they get on base, they, you know, make it a big deal.
Yeah, so, everybody's dancing and making all kinds of gestures and stuff like this. Come on, right?
Yeah, right. And you know, it's, the guys worked so hard to be as good as they were, and they do now, I'm sure, the same way they feel that way. But why would you bring that on? You know, the game has been 150 years now. And, you know, they've tried to change the game. They may, I suppose it's more entertaining. Who's entertained by that? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't. They, you know, if like I said, when I was playing, that stuff didn't go.
No.
And you were going to get nailed. Maybe the next guy was going to get hit or thrown at and all that kind of stuff. And it was like, you know, it was just nobody likes it.
It's a different world, Darryl.
Well, and for a while there, I think a lot of the guys that I played with and before and all that, you know, they stopped watching the game in a way because it was just such a different way of expressing. You know, it was like, that accomplishment that you did, if you happened to hit a home run, it was something really good, and the other team respected you for that. Now
right.
It's like, so, you know,
right.
Okay, well, that was your job. That's what we're supposed to do.
Right. Darryl Evans with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, when you became a free agent, Darryl, the Tigers and the Yankees were after your services.
Yeah.
The Yankees offered more money, but Detroit was the better team. Sparky Anderson gave you a call and kind of swayed you, but then Howard Cosell called you and said he couldn't believe you didn't sign with the Yankees. Tell us about the call from Howard Cosell.
That happened.
Yeah.
You know, I was sitting with my agent, Jerry Kepstein, in San Diego, and And also the Dodgers were in the middle of that, too. And that, like I said, I grew up in L.A.
Right.
But I played on the Braves and played on the Giants and the great rivalry of the Giants-Dodger rivalry. So, I look back and go, yeah, I hated the Dodgers. But we respected them but they always had clean uniforms and the rest of us had hand-me-downs a lot. And they acted a certain way that we didn't really like. But anyway, I become a free agent and all of a sudden, excuse me, my hometown team, because Steve Garvey, I was playing first a lot then, so Steve Garvey was signing with San Diego, so there was an opening in L.A., and the first day of spring training, they offered me a 2-year deal. The Yankees, the same thing, but George was... George was on the phone all the time. Yeah, we talked to him a bunch of times, but, they had, I was still playing third, too, and Pagliarulio was just coming up,
Right,
And then Mattingly. So there wasn't really room for me to play every day, and I was very adamant because I just had a great year in San Francisco, but of course you consider, like, this older player, how long is he going to be able to do? Is he going to, and all that kind of stuff. But, it was like, George, if I play in Yankee Stadium with that short porch in right field, I was a dead pole hitter, and he knew it and all that kind of stuff. And we went back and forth, and then it was like the Tigers came out of the blue kind of, and I didn't really know. I played in the National League for 15 years, so I didn't really know the American League very well, but of course, when the Tigers offered me a 3-year deal right away, which made me feel like really they were invested in me and they wanted me. And then I found out how great a player is and what a great team they had. We told the Dodgers and the Yankees, hey, 3-year deal and you guys are in the middle of the mix. But, George, like I said, called a bunch of times. Maybe I'll make a trade. We could do this. And I said, but, the one thing, George, I'm not going to be a DH.
Right.
Because as soon as you become a DH, was everybody thinking, you're already old. And, you can't play in anything. But that, I played 21 years and I played 160 games a year.
Right.
So
yep.
It was part of the whole, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to become known, and then, if you don't, like when Eddie and Hank, both told me that year I had 73 when I, hit those home runs and did really well and had, then Eddie told me, he goes, hey, now you got to do it every year, because if you don't do the same thing every year, everybody's going to think that, oh yeah, you're flashing the pan and stuff. So there was so many things involved. It was a fun time and everything. And, thank God I went to Detroit. Obviously, that year we won the whole thing. And we had an all-star at every position. And we should have won more, but we were in the American League East. And, that was a tough, the best division baseball by far. And it was hard to win, like we all see now. It's hard to win any time. And then in 85, I led majors in home runs.
Mm-hmm.
And, and then I told George, and I go, yeah, well, George, what if I would have been in the Yankee, in a Yankee uniform and hit and led the whole everybody in home runs? What would that have done? Would that have made you better and change and everything? So you go where you think it's best, Paul, and I can't second guess myself, but it was very flattering to have those teams wanting me still, and I was 37 years old. So,
right.
It was important for me to be able to play longer and have an opportunity to play longer. So that was basically, and like you said, and then George had some, Howard Cosell called me with my agent in San Diego, and we didn't have cell phones, and we were sitting there having dinner. And all of a sudden, the owner brings his phone. We didn't have cell phone. We they still had the phones with the long cords and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I brought it to the table, and my agent Jerry got the phone call and talked to him, whoever was on their line, said, yeah, he'll talk to you. And he didn't even tell me who it was. He gave me the phone, and it was Howard. And I was like, and he's going, what the heck are you thinking? You're not going to be in pinstripes and be a Yankee and all that, you know? And it was like, that was a pretty attractive thing, but it was turned into a fun conversation and a lot of fun.
Nice.
In the past. And you know, I can go back and go, yeah, what would that have been like to be a Yankee?
Oh, boy.
Pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Darryl, excuse me, so much more to talk to you about. I want to ask you about your managerial career, because I remember you coming out to Long Island here with the Aberdeen Arsenal playing the Ducks, and I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about the best skipper you had. We didn't talk about UFOs, which I want to talk about. So we'll have you back. We will have you back, Darryl. I'll keep in touch with you, and we'll reschedule you.
Well, I'd love to. You know, the stories get better and better the older you get, you know, so... That was all. I mean, yeah. I look back at all those opportunities I had, and people started listening to me.
Right,
it was amazing. You know, they wanted to know all about that stuff. So that was a fun time. I can't wait to talk again. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Darryl, it's been a pleasure. Again, thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here in New York. We'll see you on Facebook, and I'll give you a call.
Yeah, thank you. Well, go Bills.
That's it. Yeah. All right. That's Darryl Evans, ladies and gentlemen. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my tremendous guests, Bert Blylevin and Darryl Evans, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you guys for joining us. I'll see you next on Sunday, November 16th, for more Sports Talk New York. We will welcome in Steve Summers, the schmoozer from WFAM that night. Till then, be safe and be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.